This is the Workplace Podcast with your host, William Corliss, brought to you in association with Yellowwood, providers of executive coaching, corporate training and facilitation, your external learning and development partner. Each week, we focus on a different aspect of the workplace. We hear from guest speakers who are subject matter experts and are incredibly talented at what they do. These experts will give you a different perspective and insight to work life, with the aim of empowering you to take a different path to success in all aspects of work life. These perspectives will include career and personal success, leadership, high performance teams, and creating a better work-life culture in your organization. Yellowwood, take a different path to success with your career, team, and organization.
Welcome to the Workplace Podcast. Our topic today is the anxious achiever. Joining us today is Maura Ahrens-Mealy. Maura, welcome to the Workplace Podcast.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So Maura, you are the author of The Anxious Achiever, Turn Your Biggest Fears into Your Leadership Power, which is be our topic today. So Maura, you'd be glad to hear this. You are also the host of The Anxious Achiever podcast. And when I recommended your book and the podcast to a client, they absolutely raved about it in their next session.
Aw, thank you.
You're very welcome. And this book is such a gift to our listeners. So if you're one of those people who ruminates, has social anxiety, performance anxiety, this is the book for you. I really recommend this book. I studied the area of anxiety for many years now. So this book has really reinforced what I already know. There's so many useful tools here that I've incorporated, and I know our listeners will really appreciate that. And from a personal point of view, I've had PTSD twice now. So I really feel that this book is a guide for anybody that feels trapped by anxiety. So Maura, just on behalf of me and the listeners in advance, thank you so much.
William, thank you. I mean, if you want to talk about your personal story today, you know, I'm sure I would welcome it and your listeners would too, but it's your show. I'm honored to be here and thank you for the kind words.
Yeah. So we'll get into that. And I think it's really important to normalize, especially when we talk about leaders in the workplace. Is it an uncomfortable topic still for people? What do you think?
I think it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And for some people, it's totally easy and comfortable, right? I mean, it's a very personal thing, because a lot of how we think about mental health is about how we were raised. Did our parents talk about it, right? Was it something that we learned about? Did we take psychology 101 in high school or university? You know, there's our religious background, our cultural background, our class background. There's so many different factors. And so I find that although by and large, most people find talking about mental health in the context of work uncomfortable, it is a very personal thing as well.
And what I liked about the book is you, and a bit like what the title says in the book, is you start to reframe anxiety and letting it become your superpower. Tell our listeners about the reframe, why that's so important.
The reframe is really important because for a lot of us, we can't ever cure our anxious nature. We can't magically get rid of it with a pill or a kind of therapy or a wish. We can make it a lot better. We can make it easier to manage, but it might just be who we are, right? We may just sort of vibrate at a different level. And so rather than fighting it, it's really, really life-changing to embrace it in a way. I'm not saying this means you always listen to your anxiety or you let it control you. I mean that you truly have a relationship with it, right? You learn from it. You learn when you need to tell it to go away because it's being horrible and annoying. And you learn when it's actually trying to tell you something useful, when you're feeling motivated by it, when you're not going to sleep anyway, so you might as well at 3 a.m. make a plan, right? I want people, no matter what kind of difference they might have in their brain, whether it's anxiety or their ADHD or they're on the autism spectrum, to really learn to understand and embrace the difference.
Speaking of that difference, some people might be listening in here and go, I would just wish my anxiety away. What I'm hearing from you, it's more about making peace with the fact that we do get anxiety. It's normal, and it's learning to live with it, as in there's no silver bullet.
There's no silver bullet. As you know, anxiety lives on a spectrum. Anxiety is a completely normal and essential human emotion. It's ancient, right? It has protected us for millennia because it tells us that there might be something dangerous ahead. But anxiety can go haywire, right? And so we all feel anxiety. We all appropriately feel anxiety, right? Before a test or before a big event or when a car swerves in front of us and we're worried about the rest of the drive. And that's completely appropriate and normal and actually can be really motivating, right? Neuroscientists call anxiety good anxiety when it's the kind of anxiety that we feel before we take the stage and we just have a lot of energy and we really want to do a good job, right? And we're truly, truly ready to go. At the bottom end of the spectrum is when anxiety becomes a mental health disorder, an illness, right? Which is what I have. Anxiety is something that you may have even on a beautiful day when everything feels great, right? You feel anxiety, you seek professional help for it, right? Because it can be very, very limiting. You might avoid doing things that you really want to do because the anxiety is just too strong. And it's the most common mental health ailment in the world. A lot of us have it, and many of us aren't going to get rid of it, right? We just have to learn to manage it and even use it to our advantage. In the middle of the spectrum is something that I think is really important to talk about too, which is what a lot of people feel. They may not have a diagnosed anxiety disorder, right? They may not go to a psychiatrist or even a psychologist, but they feel a sense a lot of days that things just aren't right. They're not sleeping well. They feel worried about the future. They may feel uneasy in their body or jumpy or find it hard to pay attention. And that's something that a lot of us are feeling because the world is really uncertain and scary.
I like what you said a few moments ago. Use it to our advantage. Listen to it. It tells us something. And this is what I really liked about the book is anxiety is good data, or data, as we would say in Ireland. Tell us a bit about that, because it is informing us. It's revealing something about ourselves, like a danger or something that's concerning us.
That's right. It can be very unspecific or it can be very specific, right? We were wired to feel anxiety when there was a threat to our well-being and health and safety. However, our brain may feel that threat, and it's only our 4 p.m. sales meeting with Bob, right?
Yes.
Our brain has not evolved enough, unfortunately, to say, you feel anxious about this, but it's not a threat to you or those you love. But no matter what, our nervous system is aroused, right? Something's going on. And that is worth interrogating. I can't tell you the number of people in my many travels and conversations about anxiety at work who have said to me, you know, every week when I had to meet with my boss, I would feel nauseous the night before, or I'd always have a headache, or my arm would tingle. You know, they had a literal physical tell in their body before something happening at work that made them really uneasy. And I will always say to them, huh, why do you think that is, right? What is that anxiety trying to tell you? And it's really, really empowering to actually interrogate the anxiety. And you can do it yourself. You can do it with the help of a professional. And say, why do I feel nauseous every time I meet with my boss? Why do I feel, I had this experience, gosh, at a job a couple of years ago, we use Slack. Every time I opened up Slack, I would be so anxious because I was expecting to be shamed by my boss, who would frequently publicly shame me on Slack. And so my anxiety around even just opening my laptop became so intense, right?
And that's what I like about this book, because there's many exercises and, you know, questions, self-reflective questions and habits, a bit like what you're asking there. And then you introduce the listeners to the three different mindsets when it comes that have to change. when it comes to anxiety. So what are those mindsets then?
The first is that you have to be willing to get uncomfortable. The second is that you have to accept that you're not going to know all the answers. And you're not going to be in control. And I think the third is that you may not be able to get rid of your anxiety, but honestly, it's been a couple months since I've looked at the book.
Oh, that's okay. If people were to see a picture of everything that I have highlighted here, it is so good. And I'm going to, if that's okay with you, is it okay that I read for one part?
Yes, please. Yes.
Of it. Okay. And again here, when it comes to, I suppose, why we can't let our guard down, for example, okay, is staying on top of every detail gives you a sense of control when the unexpected happens, when your anxiety is high, and when you're dealing with the everyday stresses of work. But it's one thing to be vigilant, another thing is to feel like you have a constant monitor of your environment for threats or plan for the worst. And this is where you say it's anticipatory anxiety, fear for an extended period of time about an imagined future situation, and you see it as an unpredictable threat. And I think this is what's going on for leaders right now, isn't it? Is that we have to stay in control all the time. And it's that hypervigilance then for some people. So for you then, opening up Slack or open up your laptop, then that's putting you on high alert there that I need to protect my self-esteem or my ego or my identity or my reputation.
Right. Something bad's going to happen.
Yeah.
What's so interesting about hypervigilance, which is a sense of always being ready for threat response, right? Of scanning the environment, is that many leaders will say to me, well, that's what I'm paid for. And I say, well, that's true, but you need to learn to be able to turn the hypervigilance on and off. A lot of us who grew up in insecure families of origin, for whatever reason, many of us who were asked to be grown-ups before our time, who had the role of needing to protect mom or dad or our siblings or our own well-being, learned to be hypervigilant because that's how we thought we could stay safe. We learned that if we worked really hard and tried to maintain a sense of control, we might feel less anxious and maybe even the people around us would seem to be less anxious. And so that's our default operating mode. And then we learn that sort of behavior can be rewarded at work. When we're always scanning them, I talk to a lot of lawyers and they're like, that's what my clients expect from me. They pay me to reason out the four different scenarios that could go horribly wrong so that I'm protected. And that's a kind of hypervigilance in action. And so a lot of people say to me, well, I don't want to lose that. That's one of the pieces that makes me great. I have that. And I actually think, my ability to turn on hypervigilance is one of the things that makes me great at what I do. But the question in all of these things is this serving me? Is being in this state serving me? Do I have a way to modulate it? Can I learn to turn it off? Do I not even want to be in this state anymore, right? And just to turn the habitual and the default mode into something that feels like more of a choice.
So I'm going to move this on to performance anxiety, because it's a bit like that. Is it's when I, before I present, I always get a surge of nerves, which I've now reframed as an adrenaline surge that gets me ready.
It's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Into my optimal state. And when people see me beforehand, they're going to go, this guy's very nervous, and then I just turn it on. I go into my flow. And I think when a lot of people, when they think back about performance anxiety, a bit like that hypervigilance, it's the way we're brought up, isn't it? It's there our insecure families, or even at school where we're made up and stand up and read. I remember for me, reading out loud is because people would giggle at me if I made a mistake.
Yep.
And this stays with us then, isn't it? It's that that role of, this is what you mentioned in the book, reflexive reactions.
Like, we're conditioned to be shame, right? We're conditioned to feel shame. You know, Ellen Hendrickson, who studies social anxiety, says that a lot of our social anxiety is what she calls the fear of the reveal, right? That we'll stand up and read in front of the class and we will not be able to read well. And our peers will think we're stupid, right? That our true self will be revealed. And that often, right, we're ashamed of that true self. And we carry that into adulthood. And, you know, there's the old joke that comedians especially are just trying to get people to like them because for whatever reason, they didn't feel loved enough, right, in their youth. There's a grain of truth in this for a lot of us. And I don't actually judge that. You know, I think that many of us, we push ourselves to do things that scare us because we are seeking someone's approval. We're trying to prove someone wrong. And again, that can really make us great at what we do. But again, the question is, what is the psychological toll behind all of that, right? Is your anxiety so much? Is your performance anxiety so much? Does a simple presentation feel like it's a referendum on your character, right? And do you want to modulate that, right? Can you keep some of that incredible excellence and lose some of the anxiety and perfectionism?
And what I thought was really courageous of you is you talk about your early scripts of anxiety due to, you know, narcissistic parenting. And, you know, you talk specifically about the book about the party piece in front of the crowd where you have to turn it on. That seems quite tough for people. And I know a lot of people identify with that as, you know, do your party piece. And there's some people listening here and they would be allergic to do anything like that.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's the other funny thing about anxiety. I don't know about you, but for me, I can stand up in front of a room, no problem. I can stand up in front of 1,000 people and think that I'm entertaining and sparkly, no problem. I have a really difficult time walking into my kids' parent-teacher organization meeting and making small talk with the other moms. And I instantly assume that they don't like me and they don't want to talk to me. And, you know, I'm not one of them. Anxiety is weird. And so, again, when we understand our anxiety, we find the channels to use it, right? That further our career and make us happy. So I think that part of really understanding yourself in a professional way as well is, you know, where does my anxiety serve me and where doesn't it, right? And how can I take all the hard lessons of my life and put them to work?
And that's what I really liked about this is your understanding, for example, when you're going into that parent meeting or, you know, meeting the other parents, then it's that fear of judgment, isn't it? So that's going back to something in your childhood maybe, or it's that need to fit in, and where does that come from? And then you talked about, for some people, public speaking, like you, no problem. For me, I'm like, I have to get this right here, or I don't want to embarrass myself, or, and, you know, and it's linked to shame as well, isn't it? So when you talk to people, some people go, well, I'm reluctant to do therapy or to talk about my past or heal the wounds of the past. Is that part of leadership to go there or just to move on and ignore it? Because I'm not sure if ignoring it is a good idea. What are your own thoughts?
You have to dig in the dirt, right? The past unexamined is doomed to repeat itself. And so we see in so much of what we call toxic leadership, in my opinion, unresolved hurts, anxieties that haven't been dealt with, right? A fear to even feel emotions. And this stuff plays out. I mean, it has such powerful upstream and downstream effects. You know, we've all had that manager who was so controlling, who was such a micromanager, who wouldn't let us do anything on our own, right? Who infantilized us, who wouldn't delegate. And, you know, We may have come to really despise that manager. We may have come to think this person is terrible and I will not work for them. And that's awful for you having had that experience, but it's awful for your manager as well. That manager may have been terribly, terribly anxious and not known how to deal with their anxiety. And so what they did was they just tried to desperately keep control on everything, and micromanaging was the effect of that. Happens every single day. How much better would it have been for that manager to get some coaching or go to therapy, right? Or read a book and think, huh, why am I so scared to entrust my team with these outcomes, even though that's my job, right? And so even though it can be really uncomfortable and unflattering and scary to look this stuff in the face, the other side is just so much better.
And for many people then, anxiety can boil down to uncertainty, whether it's work, organizational change, job changes, will I get a mortgage? You know, how should people or can they deal with uncertainty?
I mean, this is the billion-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the two things that I want to say is that the first is that it's not in your head. We humans aren't meant to deal well with uncertainty, right? I mean, why would we be? And so when things feel threatening to ourselves or the people we love, we get anxious because we care for them. We want things to be okay. And so if uncertainty is making you anxious, you're normal, you know? The second is that there are so many profound systemic issues beyond our control, right? I think we all learned during the pandemic how little control we had. And I think that people, you know, I grew up with a lot of privilege. I grew up in a world where I felt like I had more control than I ever really did. People who grew up with less privilege and access than me probably knew this from a much younger age. We can't control a lot of things. And so if you're an anxious person, try to focus on controlling what you can and making peace with the rest, you know? What is within your power to change and what just isn't? We can't control mass layoffs at our company. We can't control the stock market, right? We can't control the Federal Reserve. What can we feel like we can control and will make us feel better and focus on that?
And that's where I really liked where you had a really empathetic approach to that manager that had to have control and they weren't coping well with anxiety. Was for them, there could have been a fear of failure or being judged or being out of control or uncertainty. So again, it's about being empathetic to yourself and to other people. When you see people who are anxious, that sometimes anger is just covering up a lot of fear, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, anger is an emotion I would say we're even more scared of than anxiety.
Yeah.
But again, that has gender effects, right? You know, there's data that show that men, instead of feeling anxiety, will feel anger because it's a more comfortable and socialized emotion for men to feel, whereas women are very scared to feel anger and more comfortable often with feeling anxiety. The thing about anxiety in a world of uncertainty is that it sort of pings off our past and our future. People will often say that anxiety is about everything but being in the present, and that's kind of true. And so, for example, you know, if you're someone like me who has a lot of anxiety around money and a fear of sort of scarcity around money because of our past, when we're met with a future that feels like it will have scarcity about money, so we read a headline and it says, companies are laying off, who will be next? The scary past meets the fear of the future and just creates a storm of anxiety, right?
Mm.
But understanding that and giving yourself a little bit of grace and compassion can go a long way. You know, like, yeah, this is hard for me. This is a trigger for me. I'm going to feel this more intensely. How can I help myself and prepare?
And there's one phrase that I have when we talk about uncertainty, that has really helped me. And I'm going to talk about self-care in a moment. But the phrase that I really identify with and I wrote it down, and it's right beside on a sticky note where I can see it all the time. It is, whatever happens, I can deal with it. And I love that learning that. That was such a useful reminder for me that when the pandemic came, or when I set up my business, or when I had financial issues, or, when I got PTSD for the second time, was I can deal with it, you know. Thank you so much for saying that. I'm nearly emotional now. Think about it. But when I read that message, I read it at the time when I needed it most. For me, a lot of people don't realize they have a lot of inner resources available to them. And that's where the role of self-care comes in.
Did you give yourself evidence to know that you could deal with it?
I think the evidence was for me that I was already working on pace, and the pace I worked at and the high expectations I had for myself. So this is why I really identified with even the label anxious achiever. And I know originally I think it was the ambitious achiever, I think you used to have
anxious ambition.
Yeah, sorry. And then I realized compassion was I had been through it before, and I knew what I needed to do to help me deal with that. So the likes of therapy, and you know, to manage my workload a lot better, to allow me to heal and give myself the space and the pace to really recover so I could bounce back rather than diving into work. I think what I learned before was not to get disconnected from the pain. So, you know, I changed my diet, you know, I cut back on alcohol, all the stuff that the traps that I fell into before.
Yeah.
I go, I need to be really careful here on how I really look after myself, my self-care now. And I've lost a good bit of weight now, you know, I look good, you know, I get lots of compliments now. I'm physically really healthy, still doing physio and all that and therapy. And I feel in a place where I can really deal with things now. Whereas if I hadn't done that, I probably would be in a very different position.
Wow. That's really powerful. And I mean, I think it was really brave of you to take the risk on behaviors that probably felt a lot harder than old behaviors, you know, but in the end really helped. And the reason why I ask about evidence is that, you know, if you've ever done cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, one of the first things they'll ask you to do is if you have a negative thought, you know, that is not necessarily based in reality, that's just an automatic negative thought, they'll ask you to sort of provide evidence to maybe counter that thought, right? And it sounds so silly, but to me, it's been so life-changing. You know, again, for example, the money anxiety example is a really powerful one. If you're feeling like you are catastrophizing in your head around financial news, and there's plenty of bad financial news out there, you know, and it really triggers you and it really makes you worry and lose sleep, and you can see yourself, you know, for me, my catastrophizing around money was so powerful during the pandemic. I just thought my business was going to fail and I was going to lose my house and all these just anxious thoughts. I learned to literally have pieces of paper with evidence that I could read, you know, to help just calm and counteract that anxious thought, you know, like, here's your financial reports. If your business failed, here's what would happen, you know, model it out. Like, if you're someone who needs to see numbers and this stuff makes you anxious, model out scenarios. You know, I think that trying to train your brain to rely on something that's more neutral and fact-based rather than just the anxiety is really powerful. And saying, I can get through this, and here's how I know that,
I do something very similar, or my wife will remind me to go, I think you need to look at your accounts package. You know, and yeah. She reminds me that, and look at the scenarios, and then she'll remind me of the evidence before. And speaking of evidence, then, and I've said this before in the podcast, I keep a lovely folder, a physical folder, and also a soft copy of this. And when I get emails or I get, you know, lovely positive feedback, then I keep it in a folder called Project Wellbeing. And within that then is evidence that, you know, I'm okay at what I do, or even, you know, quite successful at what I do. And it's when that brain is going into overdrive, then it's that way of calming it down. So that's where that evidence-based fact
I love it
comes in. So the,
I do the same thing.
Isn't it great to do that? Yeah.
It's everyone needs a brag book or a clips file or Project Wellbeing. I think that is an amazing tactic. I think the other thing I just want to say is that, you know, I don't know about you, but for me, sometimes just being on social media triggers my anxiety around performance and financial well-being and comparisons, right? Another huge thought trap we get into, comparing yourself to other people, that sometimes it's okay just to turn off social media, you know, and just be like, I'm not going to partake in this because it's making my anxiety bad. And that's okay too, because social media is actually designed to make us anxious.
It's a really good point. And another nugget for our listeners, you know, the comparison. So I'm a twin.
Oh.
And I'm so used to that script of, you know, comparing, you know, for both of us, it was actually very damaging to our psyche. And that comparing thing wasn't great. And even with my older siblings, you know, being compared to them, and they're all, you know, successful in their own right. But I remember a scenario where I just went in and started reflecting on my inner critic and that inner script that was going on. And then I reframed it to go, there's lots of people here, you know, and I'm comparing myself to my siblings here. And then I realized anybody in this room, you know, wouldn't be able to compare themselves. Maybe I put them up on a pedestal, and I was kind of going, well, actually, I'm just glad to be their brother. And I went from a change of gratitude, and that I've access to these people at any time that I want, of a sense of gratitude. And it really allowed me to change then how I started comparing myself to others. And then, for example, when I'm on the podcast now speaking to people, then, you know, I just invite this in, and instead of getting performance anxiety, I go, I have such an opportunity here to speak to an expert or someone that I admire or someone that I really respect. And then I reframe that. So I think that making peace with that inner critic, having a chat with that, and really exploring that out. And that's the beauty about this book, Maura. Such a gift.
Sometimes I let my inner critic have free rein, and I am perfectionistic, and I just push myself too hard. And that's okay too. You know, like, I think, I mean, the amazing thing about being an adult is I have three kids, so I'm always like, it's great to be an adult, is that you can decide. And, you know, sometimes the inner critic is awful and you want it to go away, and you're going to use those techniques. And sometimes the inner critic is going to push you to accomplish things, and that's great too. And so I just want people to have a sense of agency.
When you talk about therapy, and you talked about this before in the book, is the sweetheart method. And I love this. Can you tell our listeners what that approach to is? So we talk about well-being then. I love this approach.
I love this. This is my psychiatrist, who I actually dedicated the book to, Dr. Carol Birnbaum in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You know, this hits right to those of us whose inner critic is loud and mean, right? And vocal in our ears and talks to us just in a really nasty way, right? I don't know about you, but my inner critic loves to tell me how lazy I am and loves to compare me with other people and tell me that I'm a failure. And if only I worked harder, I'd be further along. Or if only I knew what I was doing and I wasn't such an imposter and I had gotten a PhD, I'd be in a way. Anyway, I mean, God, she could go on for hours. And my psychiatrist said to me one day, you know, when this is all out of control, what if you just talk to yourself and call yourself sweetheart, you know? And you've heard this before, right? Would you talk to yourself? Would you talk to your best friend the way that you talk to yourself? No, a lot of us would say, oh my God, no. And so maybe, you know, calling yourself sweetheart and saying, you know, sweetheart, you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself. How about we just do this and then we call it a day? I would do this all the time when I was writing my book, you know, because not when I was writing the book, when I was promoting it last year, because, you know, you're in this sort of endless cycle of I could always do more. They're a bestseller. How come I'm not a bestseller? Like, you could really keep yourself up at night. And I would just sort of use the sweetheart voice and say, you know what, sweetheart, you've already done 3 podcasts today and you've written this and you've done this. Like, let's just call it a night. You know, you did a good job today, because no one else is really going to tell you that again as an adult. And so being kind to yourself, there's reams of data around this, can really help not just calm anxiety, but change habits of being hypercritical to yourself.
Love that sweetheart method. I am definitely going to practice a little bit more along with the I can deal with it. I loved that deal with it. And it gives me such a boost of confidence when you do these things. So let's go back to family dysfunction then. So we talked about your earlier inner scripts, okay? And then you talked about Bowen theory and how it's related to work life. So I thought this was fascinating.
Yeah. So Bowenian family systems theory is a school of psychology. And, you know, most of us will know about systems theory. I have a chapter about this in the book, and I can really recommend the work of Dr. Kathleen Smith, because she's who I learned a lot of this stuff from. But, you know, we all grow up in a system, and that's our family, right? It's what's called a closed system, right? It's a group of certain people, and we all react off of each other and draw a great amount of self-esteem and nourishment and shame often from each other. And we each have a role in our family of origin. I am the firstborn. I grew up in a single parent, by and large, household, where my role was really to figure things out and make other people feel better and get things done, you know, and take care. And so I'm, in systems theory, a classic overfunctioner, meaning I will get things done for you. I'm very competent. If you have a problem, I will figure out a solution and I probably won't ask for help. Might sound familiar to a lot of people out there. Now, great. I can do so many things. I'm so good at what I do. Yay. Well, not so great. A, because it's really causes me a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress. And B, for every overfunctioner, there has to be an underfunctioner, right? This is another role in the family system. So for every time I at work say, I got it, don't worry about it, you take the rest of the day off, I'll take care of it, what am I doing? I'm adding pressure to myself and probably making myself feel good because I'm playing a role that I'm used to playing, but I'm letting someone else off the hook. I'm letting them underfunction. I'm not helping them grow and be great and do what they need to do. And so the way we acted in our families of origin, if we keep acting out these patterns, again, has profound effects on how we work and the people we work with.
That is fascinating, isn't it? How this early life script keeps going, revisiting our lives as adults and especially into the workplace.
You look at people who are entrepreneurs, there's a fascinating body of growing research on the brains and psyches and mental health of people who become entrepreneurs. A lot of entrepreneurs are different, and a lot of entrepreneurs have childhood trauma that powers them. I mean, in a way, it's the oldest story in the book, right? It's Dickens, but it's true.
So that's the over functioner. Okay. So, but the under functioner, they're kind of going, well, we're just getting a free ride here, or we're not being fully developed. Is there other aspects where I might recognize an under functioner in the workplace? Because it seems like they're getting an easy ride, but I'm sure it's not the case.
I mean, I would say that if you've ever been told that you have so much potential, you might be an under functioner, you know, and we're not under functioners across the board. We may be incredibly high performing, but there's one person with whom we under function because they over function for us, right? It's not all black and white. But, you know, I think that if you think about, if you're a manager and you think about your team and there's that person on the team, you might also have someone on the team who's really charming and funny and everyone loves them, but somehow they get other people to do their work for them. You might have someone who you see avoids doing things, right? So really keeping an eye out for people's behavior and, again, approaching it from a place of empathy versus judging.
So that under-functioner was probably the youngest then. The over-functioner is the eldest. And the...
Not always.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
No, I mean, again, I don't know the science on birth order and this stuff that well, but no, I don't think it's about birth order necessarily, although obviously there's a lot of sort of firstborn theory out there. Your role is dependent on a lot of factors.
No, I must say there is this notion that you have introduced to our readers here is being a C+ student. And I must have mentioned this since I read the book at least 150 times. Be a C+ student. Now, some people are listening in and they are horrified that I might ask them to lower their levels or standards for themselves. What is a C+ student? Why is that important to our listeners?
A C+ student, this is actually a term that my incredible friend and massage therapist, Steve Cunningham, told me to do. But it's really around the concept of assigning the right level of effort into a task. You know, those of us anxious achievers, often we operate on autopilot and we just give everything our all. And we also imbue a lot of emotion and meaning into outcomes, right? So we may walk into an assignment with the assumption that if we don't get this perfect, we're not going to get promoted, right? We're not going to be successful. Our boss isn't going to think that we're worthy or smart, right? That's just how we roll. And it would never occur to us, right, to do anything less than the absolute maximum. Or sometimes, because the pressure is so high, we can't even get started at all, right? Because it's like, oh my God, well, this will never be as good as it needs to be. So I can't, why bother? And the idea of being a C+ student is really around assigning, in a spirit of experimentation, the right amount of effort to a task and learning from the outcome, right? Not everything deserves our absolute most. And so what if we're just a C+ student, right? What if we aim for that, 78 on 100 on 100 scale? And what does that feel like? How many hours does that take us? What's the response? Wow, people seem to like my C+ work. That's interesting. What's that telling me, right? About how I'm goal setting and assigning my time and worrying so much. And so if there's something that you could try being a C+ student at, it's wonderful. And it doesn't have to be a work thing. Like, I'm a really, really mediocre student at yoga and tennis, which I really love to do, but I'm really just not that great at. And it's been a transformative experience in my life to do something regularly and really never get better or be told I'm good at it.
I love that notion. And some people might recognize themselves. So you might be the person who spends 20 minutes looking for the perfect PowerPoint image or PowerPoint slide when really doesn't matter. You know, that, you know, there's the it can be cause burnout, it can cause time management issues. There's loads of things, areas in our life where we could be more of a C plus student. Is there any other examples where people could go, okay, you're spending too much time on this or too much effort?
I mean, I actually recommend to people, if this is an issue for them, that they measure it, their time, or they set limits, because that can be really powerful, right? Say you're working on that PowerPoint and you just find yourself working late every night, worrying about it, or you can't stop editing a document, right? Because it feels so important. Think about the last time you did something that your boss liked in this vein. And think about how much time it took you. Like, maybe the PowerPoint took you 5 hours and it was a good PowerPoint and your boss liked it and you won the business. Okay, great. So you have a similar assignment now. You're going to spend 5 hours on it. You're not going to spend more. You're not going to spend less. You're going to spend 5 hours because that is what you need to do to produce a product that is good. You know, sometimes anxiety can take over and we just let go of reason. And so having like evidence, right? Having limits that you can enforce that you know will get you where you need to be is really helpful.
Really helpful. Thank you for that. Now I'm going to shout this out loud and I'm going to surprise you. I am a banana. Why? Why should anybody use this technique, the ACT technique or the ACT technique?
This is from Russ Harris, who is a doctor and one of the leaders of ACT therapy. And I love it so much. So, you know, again, coming back to that inner critic and that worrying voice, Dr. Harris was a surgeon and he was very anxious. He had a lot of imposter feelings. He worried and he had a lot of doubt. And so he would find himself performing a procedure on a patient and thinking while he was doing it, why did they agree to hire me? I'm terrible. I'm probably going to mess up. They really shouldn't have come to me. There's so many better people out there. You know, all these really negative and probably damaging thoughts for outcomes, right? And then one day he sort of realized, this is a lot of words I'm throwing around, again, without a lot of evidence. What if I just replaced all these negative words with silly words? And so instead of saying to himself, I'm a terrible surgeon, he would say, I'm a banana, which sounds silly. And that's the point. Some people will sing, like I sing a failure song. So when I start thinking about what a failure I am, I'll just sing it to Happy Birthday. I'm a failure, it's true. I'm a big loser. I'm gonna lose everything. I mean, it sounds really ridiculous, but the truth is our negative thoughts and our anxious thoughts are just words. And so giving it that bit of distance really can help flip the script.
I had a client before and we did this coaching exercise and they decided to the inner voice that was going through their head to assign that a cartoon voice.
Yep.
And name that character Uncle Timmy. And whenever they heard that, they used to go, okay, that's the voice again. And that person still, when I ever bump into them or whatever, they still tell me, I'm still able to turn down the volume on Uncle Timmy or tell Uncle Timmy to go away because it's so absurd. It's wonderful to hear. And I remember when I heard it first in the coaching session, they come up with it, obviously. And I was like, that is brilliant. So we're coming to the end of our podcast. Okay, so before we do, we were talking about leadership and work. And this final question then is, should I be vulnerable with my team on anxiety? Is there a place where we should be private about it, or is there a place where we create that psychological safety by opening up to our team about anxiety and encouraging others to be vocal about it?
I mean, it depends, right? I think that it depends on how comfortable you feel. It depends on your relationships with your team members. It depends on the team members, where you work. But I will say that if it's something you feel motivated to do, that's great. And I would also say, do it with care and caution. You know, it's really important that leaders are seen as leaders. And it's important to hit the right note, because nobody wants their leader. It's like parenting. Nobody wants their leader to be a mess, because then we lose trust, right? We get scared. We think, oh my gosh, if they're a mess, how bad are things really, right? And so that can be really unsettling to a team. But, and study after study shows this, we love leaders who are human, who are vulnerable, who are empathetic, and who are authentic and self-aware above all, right? Who know themselves. And so if you can try to work on hitting the balance between being a really competent, right? As Amy Cuddy says, a competent leader who's going to show up for their team and do the best, you can also be the real human you are, who frankly has no idea what the hell lies around that next corner. And it's okay to be both.
Thank you so much for that. And if people were to find more about you, your book, and your podcast, how might they do so?
Well, you can listen to The Anxious Achiever wherever you get your podcasts, and you can buy The Anxious Achiever book wherever you buy your books. I would love it, frankly, if you connected with me on LinkedIn. I'm really active on LinkedIn. The Anxious Achiever is a podcast sponsored by LinkedIn. So come find me there, and I'll write you back.
Maura Ahrens Mealy, thank you so much for joining the Workplace Podcast today.
Thanks, William. It was an honor.
Thanks for listening to the Workplace Podcast with your host, William Corliss. Our special thanks to this episode's guest for sharing their expertise with us. If you found this episode valuable, please rate and review it. For updates on future episodes and to get in contact with us about any workplace topics, please follow Yellowwood on LinkedIn and Twitter at Different Paths. As always, you can head over to yellowwood.ie for any other information. Yellowwood, your external learning and development partner. Provider of executive coaching, facilitation, and training. Take a different path to success with your career, leadership, team, and organization.